Good afternoon, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participant lines are in a listen-only mode. During the Q&A session, if you would like to ask a question, you may do so over the phone by pressing star one. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect. It is my pleasure to turn the call over to your host for today, Mr. Benjamin Haynes. Thank you, sir. You may begin.
Thank you, Holly, and thank you all for joining us today. We are joined by CDC Monkeypox Response Incident Manager, Dr. Chris Braden, and White House National Monkeypox Response Deputy Coordinator, Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis. They will talk about new monkeypox vaccine effectiveness data and our call to action as we go into the summer months. Following their remarks, we will be joined for the Q&A by Eli Rosenberg, the Deputy Director for Science in the New York State Department of Health's Office of Public Health and author of the New York MMWR. I want to note that this briefing is embargoed until today at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when the report will go live on the CDC website. I'll now turn the call over to Dr. Braden.
Thank you, Ben. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining. A year ago today, CDC issued our first report about Mpox, then known as monkeypox, in the United States. Since then, more than 30,000 domestic Mpox cases were reported, more than 140,000 specimens were tested, more than 1.2 million doses of vaccines were administered, and more than 6,900 patients were treated with the antiviral tecovirimat. The Mpox outbreak occurred with little warning, peaked in August with about 460 cases a day. Cases declined to an average of about one per day at this point, but the outbreak is not over, and we need to remain alert and continue our prevention efforts. Today, we are here to talk about the latest data we have on the effectiveness of vaccines for the prevention of Mpox. New data from three sources, two MMWRs and the New England Journal of Medicine article, support using JYNNEOS as a two-dose series for Mpox prevention and incorporating JYNNEOS into a broader program of sexual health services. Data from these studies indicate that JYNNEOS provides substantial protection against Mpox regardless of how it was administered or whether the recipient was immunocompromised. One study used case and control data from 12 jurisdictions from just New York, and the third included national data from electronic health records. Vaccine effectiveness estimates from these studies range from 36 to 75% for one dose and 66 to 86% for two doses of JYNNEOS vaccine. And all routes of administration, that is, subcutaneous or intradermal, provide similar protection. These studies conducted over the past year reinforced the importance of receiving two doses for optimal protection. While more than 1.2 million people have received at least one dose of JYNNEOS, less than a quarter of the population at risk has been fully vaccinated. The data also shows that there is a wide variation in vaccine rates by jurisdiction and among those who have received the most benefit from the vaccine, meaning the chances of renewed outbreaks go up when fewer people have been vaccinated. Earlier this year, CDC released projections that foreshadowed the risk of Mpox resurgence is higher in jurisdictions with low vaccine coverage. Jurisdictions with less than 35% coverage of at least one vaccine dose are more likely to have outbreaks, which could be as large or even larger than those in 2022. And while the World Health Organization recently declared the outbreak no longer represents a public health emergency, a cluster of Mpox cases occurred in Chicago, demonstrating the ongoing risk for new cases and outbreaks and the need for continued vigilance and prevention efforts. Now I'll turn it over to Dr. Daskalakis to talk about what we know about the cases in Chicago and what action people at risk can take as we head into the summer.
Thank you so much, Dr. Braden. This is Dimitri Daskalakis. Earlier this month, Howard Brown Health in Chicago and the Chicago Department of Health announced that they had detected a cluster of Mpox cases with updated reports indicating now that 21 people have been diagnosed with Mpox as a part of this cluster. So far, most of the cases that have been reported have been in men who identify as gay, bisexual, or other same gender-loving men, and all have had mild symptoms. What's really unique about this cluster is that most of the cases are in people who have had one or both vaccine doses. Right now, we don't know why people in this cluster of cases has gotten Mpox after vaccination. There are a number of possible explanations, and what's important is that CDC staff are assisting the Chicago Health Department to help find answers. We also don't know some components of the vaccine. We don't know if immunity after vaccination decreases with time or how long the vaccine protects against Mpox infection. Several ongoing studies are looking at this issue now, and we will be examining data from these studies closely for clues. What we do know, however, is that vaccination makes getting and spreading Mpox less likely, and importantly, may decrease the chances of severe illness, hospitalization, and death, even if it doesn't prevent infection. And as Dr. Braden mentioned, earlier this year, CDC put out some really important modeling toward this and asked the question, how high does the vaccination rate need to be in a jurisdiction to prevent Mpox outbreaks? He shared that information with you earlier. What that modeling found is that the more immunity that we have in the community, the lower the chance it is that we will have any outbreaks. Simply put, higher vaccination rates equal lower risk for an outbreak. So, even though no vaccine is perfect, even imperfect immunity in many people still means a lot of immunity in the population. And then the result is, with that increased immunity, we are less likely to have any outbreaks at all or have smaller outbreaks. However, it is important to say that without renewed prevention efforts, especially vaccination, we are definitely at risk of a resurgence, in fact, a substantial risk of resurgence of Mpox. This is especially a concern as we approach summer with the planned and joyous gatherings that may, however, have high potential for skin-to-skin contact or that are associated with increased sexual activity. Most new cases continue to be in gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men, as well as transgender and other gender-diverse people. A disproportionate number of cases throughout this entire outbreak have been among Black and Hispanic or Latino men. So we have a mission at hand. So our charge to those in the LGBTQI+ community, as well as those who care for them and provide service, is to really help get them fully vaccinated. Now is the time to get vaccinated. If you didn't get your first dose, get it. And if you didn't get your second dose, get that. Seek health care and get tested if you have a rash, even if you have been previously vaccinated or had Mpox in the past. What we need to be is ready to use all the tools in the Mpox prevention toolkit that includes vaccine, testing, and importantly, education so that people can make informed decisions about their sex lives to halt the spread and protect their health and the health of their community. Getting summer ready means Mpox vaccination, but that's not all it means. It also means being up to date on all of your sexual health, and that includes HIV and STIs like syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. With that, I'll turn it back to Ben so we can turn it over to some questions. Ben.
Thank you, Dr. Daskalakis. Holly, we are ready to open up for questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please unmute your phone, press star 1, and record your first and last name slowly and clearly when prompted so I may introduce you. To withdraw your request, please press star 2. Again, to ask a question, press star 1. Our first caller is Spencer Kimball with CNBC. You may go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I have a question about the vaccine estimates in these studies. Like you all were saying, in the New England Journal of Medicine study, it's 36% for one dose, 66% for two doses. In the MMWR, I think it was 75 and 85. So that's a pretty big range, particularly when it comes to the first dose. Can you just explain why there is such a wide range in these estimates? What was different between the studies? Thank you.
Chris Braden speaking. I'll take a stab at that question. Thank you, and it's a very good one. The first thing I would like to point out is that it's advantageous to have multiple studies to understand what vaccine effectiveness really is in the population. So these are three different studies that we're publishing today. Each has a different data source. They have different methods and a different source of the data that they're looking at in their methodology. So we need the different types of studies looking at data in different ways in order to come to probably a combined estimate that looks at across these studies to come to what may be the best estimate of vaccine effectiveness. The other thing I would like to point out, and this is especially true for the two doses, is that each of the estimates is within the confidence intervals of each individual study. So in statistically, they're not all that different. But I do get the issue that, especially for the New England Journal of Medicine study, that the estimated estimate is lower than in the other studies. A couple of things about the New England Journal of Medicine study, I think, to point out. It is a strong study in that it has a lot of power in the number of cases and controls that were involved using a national database of anonymized medical records. The other thing about the New England Journal of Medicine study is that all the eligible cases and controls were included in the analysis. The other case control studies depended upon the voluntary provision of information from cases and controls to be able to include the data in the analysis. And that volunteering, that aspect of volunteering can introduce some bias to the estimates, either underestimating or overestimating the vaccine effectiveness. The other thing that I would like to point out is that we still don't know enough about the effect of this vaccine in the population of immunocompromised patients. And if you look at the New England Journal of Medicine article, when they did a secondary analysis, when they excluded immunocompromised persons, the vaccine effectiveness for two doses actually went from 66% to 76%. More in line with what we see with the other studies. But what we need to know more about the vaccine effectiveness in that group, and it's an important group to study in our additional studies. I'll leave it at that and see if there's anybody else that has comments.
Hey, this is Eli Rosenberg in New York. I'll just add my endorsement of that. You know, in those remarks that we here in public health really, you know, we often rely on triangulation for multiple data sources to arrive at truth. And that's really the case for these three studies. You know, here in our, you know, our study today in MMWR really echoes the findings of the other two, particularly the other one in MMWR finding up to 88% effectiveness for two doses. And that study is using all reportable data in New York for both cases and immunizations outside of New York City. So I think everything that was just said was really quite spot on, and these are all really quite statistically similar and compatible estimates.
Next question. This is Dimitri. I'm just going to add a quick thing on top of the excellent comments that Chris and Eli made, which is, you know, this is it's not atypical in other areas to think about different sort of approaches and studies to model how something functions. So thinking even about weather, like you use different models to identify like what weather patterns are going to be like. And so different methodologies mean different views, and they do inform us in the same way, which is one dose is good and two doses better. And it's also important to remember that this really focuses on prevention of infection. And even beyond the vaccine effectiveness measured with those outcomes is the sort of other issue that we see reduction in some of the adverse outcomes of MPOX, which makes this really important. So as a weather forecast, this definitely tells us that these vaccines work and that our strategy of vaccinating people and getting both doses really remains core to our efforts to prevent MPOX. Thanks.
Next question, please.
Our next caller is Martin Espinoza with Press Democrat. You may go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Hello? Go on.
Oh, yeah. One of the speakers spoke to this with regard to the effect of the vaccine on the population of immunocompromised. Do we have any information about the 21 in Chicago, whether we know if the majority of them were immunocompromised?
I'll start, Chris, and maybe you can, if there's other data that you want to share. So I think that what we know from Chicago is that, you know, the investigation is still ongoing, and I think that we do have some folks within the cluster who have pre-existing conditions that could qualify them for immunocompromise, but many of them are under very good control. So I think as the investigation unfolds, we'll learn more. But there, at least on surface, does not seem to be a specific trend from the perspective of the immune status of the individuals. It seems as if it's not a player. Chris, I'm not sure if you have anything to add there.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And one of the questions that we get asked quite a bit is whether or not these cases that had previous vaccination were also co-infected with HIV. And some of them were. Of the 21 cases, we know of 5 that were also infected with HIV, but they were well controlled. And what we know so far, looking at some of the information about the vaccine effectiveness, is that for people who have HIV well controlled, the vaccine is still quite effective in that population.
Next question, please, Holly.
Our next caller is Alexander Tin with CBS News. You may go ahead.
Hi, thanks for doing this. Dr. Braden, you mentioned a combined estimate. Can you clarify what you think that combined estimate is right now based on these studies? How does that change your risk assessments and modeling? And Dr. Daskalakis, you mentioned those ongoing studies. What are the chances you think that additional boosters might be green-lighted this summer, like for men who only got intradermal or ACAM2000?
So I'll take the question about the combined estimate, what we take away from these 3 studies is that the vaccine effectiveness is substantial, and that 2 doses is definitely better than 1. Being vaccinated will help decrease the spread of Mpox in populations. It will help individuals prevent the acquisition of Mpox, and it will help individuals avoid severe disease or even death in those that are susceptible to the very severe disease. So there's a number of things that we can take away from these 3 studies that I think are very important in that way.
Hi there, it's Dimitri. I'll take the second part of the question, which is, I think what's really important is that we have the studies that are ongoing to really ask some of the questions around durability of vaccine. And so I think we've already really immediately after seeing sort of the Chicago cluster convened folks within the U.S. government to discuss what the data is that we have and if there needs to be any change in vaccine strategy. I just want to clarify one quick thing. There is no current change in vaccine strategy. And I want to just again emphasize that, as you heard from Dr. Braden, there's no difference between the subcutaneous and intradermal in terms of its vaccine effectiveness in the studies that will be released today. So there's specifically no indication for folks, if they've gotten 2 doses of vaccine at this time, to get any additional doses. So I think the exciting news is that we are like on it from the perspective of having the scientific discussions, and are obviously, as sort of demonstrated in the track record of the response, really adjust our strategy based on what science is showing us. And so I think we're really in that learning more about Chicago and making sure we maximize what we know about vaccines so we can make informed decisions. Thank you so much for your question.
Next question, please.
Our next question is from Christopher Kane with Washington Blade. You may go ahead.
Hey, I really appreciate your taking my question. Dr. Dimitri, I'm wondering your mention of the fact that that we're going to see perhaps an increased risk this summer of new outbreaks. Is there anything you can preview in terms of whether our federal health agencies are going to administer like vaccine drives or outreach initiatives at Pride celebrations and that kind of thing?
Sure, it's a great question. So we've been on a world tour, as I like to call it, in the U.S., really focusing on organizers of events, including folks who really are the umbrella organizations for a lot of the prides, including some specific Black prides, and are working really closely with CDC to be able to make linkages in the event that that there is interest to actually have vaccine affiliated with events. So I think that, you know, we are really working on the matchmaking side of this. We have vaccine and we have willing organizations to do it. We have resources from the perspective of the flexibility built into HIV and STI funding to allow for this work, as well as the crisis COAG, which a cooperative agreement that provided even more resources locally for such efforts. So the answer is yes. So I think we are really poised to make sure that we're promoting the possibility of vaccination affiliated with events, and really working with organizers and local public health to see where those opportunities exist and where they make sense. Thank you for your question.
Next question, please.
Our next caller is Mike Stobie with the Associated Press. You may go ahead.
Hi, thanks for calling on me. I wanted to ask, you said earlier that about less than one quarter of those who are fully at risk are those are at risk or fully vaccinated. Can you tell us the denominator or the most recent denominator? Like, what is that, 1 million, 1.5 million? I'm just trying to get to how many people in America are fully vaccinated at this point. And could you also discuss vaccine supply going into the summer? Like, how many doses are available and how have you distributed them? Thank you.
Chris, do you want me to start or do you want to start? Either way.
Go ahead, Dimitri.
Yes, sir. So the estimates that were made for the denominator really are stable from previous discussions of them. And so the denominator is an estimate. It is based on HIV surveillance data as well as surveillance data around pre-exposure prophylaxis eligibility in the U.S., mainly among gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men. In addition to that, because of the recommendation that partners are also included in the sort of vaccine eligibility, there is also a correction factor of about 25%. So the estimate, all comers, men who have sex with men who could benefit from HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis, plus men who have sex with men who are living with HIV, with men at 25% correction factor, really takes us to a denominator of about 1.7 million individuals who could benefit from vaccine. I will then take the question of supply. So I'll just start by a very different place in vaccine supply than we were in spring, summer 2022. So with the introduction of intradermal dosing, we've been able to extend what supplies we do have by making each individual vial a multi-dose vial. We have worked with the company that produces the Jynneos vaccine to increase production and have also created a fill and finish facility in Michigan to actually make sure that we have domestic fill and finished vaccine that has that site has cleared FDA. So that vaccine produced at that site is now in the strategic national stockpile. As it stands today, there is vaccine that's been distributed, almost a million vials. Some of that is still out on the edges with jurisdictions, and still available for order is about 400,000 vials, with the potential of going deeper into the supply if it's indicated or necessary. So I think that that in terms of a supply, like I said, because of the multiple domains of work to increase vaccine supply, I think that we're in a really good position to make sure that we cover the folks who could benefit from vaccine. Thank you.
Next question, please.
Our next question is Matthew Chase with Newsday. You may go ahead.
Hey there, thanks for taking the question. Can you guys, in simple terms, provide the percentages about whether the vaccine just mitigates the effects of disease, protects the vaccinated person from having any symptoms whatsoever, protects the vaccinated person from getting the virus, or totally stops infection in both the vaccinated person and an exposed second or third or other person. And also, what method are you using to give the vaccine? Are you still stretching it, or are you going with the original method?
So I'll jump in. This is Chris Braden. And thank you for that question. It's very insightful because I think it's worth emphasizing that the vaccine effectiveness estimates that we're talking about today is for symptomatic infection that's been basically attended by the medical system. So that vaccine effectiveness is really specific to that situation. When you talk about vaccine effectiveness for severe disease, it's a different calculation, and we would estimate that vaccine effectiveness for more severe disease is actually higher than for any disease because we have other information that would tell us that vaccination, even if you are infected and have some illness, it's going to be less severe if you've been vaccinated. So the other type of vaccine effectiveness that you talked about is effectiveness in preventing spread. And that's a different calculation, and it's actually one that is very difficult to study. So that's one where we don't have a lot of information about vaccine effectiveness to prevent the spread of the virus. So we need to be cognizant about what we're actually talking about when we talk about these particular vaccine estimates that are being published today. The second question was, repeat that, please.
Are you using the original method, or are you still stretching it to get the five doses?
Yes. Okay, so the original method was the subcutaneous dosing, and then the intradermal dosing is a smaller dose, so you can get more doses out of a vial. So it is advantageous to be able to use the smaller dose. It provides more vaccine to more people, but it is up to the preference of the provider and the patient as to which route they actually receive.
Our next question, please.
Our next question is from Tom Ray with the Illinois Eagle. You may go ahead.
Yes, my question is the CDC doing any outreach to local health departments outside of large cities, or what kind of outreach they're doing? Because we did see cases outside of Chicago here in Illinois. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sorry about that. Yes. Dr. Vasglaska, can you want to take that one?
So I can speak for at least the White House outreach. So we definitely have been doing outreach beyond just cities. I think that we routinely are having meetings and have done so actually for the duration of the response with health departments that really represent like states, not just cities. So through various organizations like CSTE, ASTO, as well as work that focuses on big cities. The other piece is that the outreach that we've conducted with providers as well as organizers of events really have spanned both large, medium, and small cities as well as rural spaces as well. So I think that definitely we continue on that same path that we've really been on since the beginning of the outbreak and have really intensified really in the last 2 and 3 months those conversations in various types of jurisdictions as we prepare for spring, summer, just realizing, again, that people who may not be in a city may go to a city for events. And so all of that has been a part of what we've been talking about. Additionally, we're doing pretty significant outreach to medical providers, and I think you're going to see more of that today with sort of letters to providers reminding them to review their lists of humans who could potentially benefit from vaccine, and if they are not vaccinated, to recall them to make sure that they get vaccinated. So I think, yeah, the short answer to the question is yes, and we have really been doing so in terms of outreach since the beginning of this outbreak. Chris, is it was a CDC-specific dynamic. Anything that you have to add there on this question?
Well, I would just say that, you know, and CDC has been able to support a number of jurisdictions, both in cities or in counties or in entire states where they are planning for the prevention activities, promotion of vaccines, et cetera, through a number of different types of support, including grants to jurisdictions and to community-based organizations. So trying to do a force multiplier effort to be able to support as many jurisdictions as possible with both funding and with technical support going forward.
This is Eli.
Go ahead, Eli.
Oh, I just wanted to add one thing to the previous question, because we didn't get to sort of the plain English interpretation, and I wasn't sure if I could just jump in if that would still be helpful.
By all means.
Okay, great. So I think was important was just, you know, as Dr. Brain just clarified, these studies were looking at the prevention of sort of a diagnosed infection, a medically attended symptomatic kind of infection. But when we look at the numbers, we see a really important signal of what the preventive power here is. So depending on the picking on the two MMWR studies, you know, 86% or 88% vaccine effectiveness for two doses means that if you take a vaccinated person compared to an unvaccinated person, we're estimating that during this outbreak last year that they had about an 86 or an 88% lower chance of acquiring symptomatic mpox, and that was diagnosed. That's just remarkable prevention, a real incredible level of prevention, but has already been discussed on this call. It's not 100%. And so, yes, 88%, 86% is incredible, but sometimes we might expect what has sometimes been called a breakthrough infection, or essentially a situation where a vaccine hasn't provided protection. And that's why we say that this is an important layer of protection on top of all the other prevention strategies that we've all been messaging about. So I think that's sort of the important piece, very, very high protection for vaccinated people compared to an equivalent unvaccinated person.
Next question, please, Holly.
Our next question is from Lynn Peterson with Trends in Medicine. You may go ahead.
Can you give us some more details, please, about the 21 patients? It's not severe, but did any of them have to be hospitalized? What kind of outbreak? How is it diagnosed? Just some more depth on that, please.
Chris, I'll start and then I'll hand it over to you. So the 21 cases, as you've heard, have been very mild. To date, we've not heard of hospitalizations, which is great news. We're also hearing that the mucosal symptoms, or the painful involvement that we tended to see in the outbreak before, so the rectal symptoms, that's been very limited in the folks in this cluster. Additionally, like even the number of lesions that they have also appears to be smaller, at least in the initial review of the individuals who had mpox after vaccination. So I'll say that, again, the CDC continues to do the investigation, and so we're going to learn more, and I'm sure Chicago will also share more as they learn more as well. But I think the overarching message, at least anecdotally so far, is that we're seeing very mild disease. Chris, did I cover that okay?
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Holly, we have time for one more question.
All right, and our last question comes from Benjamin Ryan with NBC News. You may go ahead.
Hi, everyone. I'm wondering about what kind of research you're doing into the potential for waning immunity from either previous infection or vaccination.
Yeah, this is Chris Braden. Thank you for the question, and it really is a a central issue, and we are looking into this in a number of ways. At CDC, we have three current ongoing studies. One where Mpox has been endemic for a long time in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where they've had a trial using the JYNNEOS vaccine now for some period of time, but also in the current outbreak, we have studies ongoing in Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles. We hope to be looking at some of the early data on those studies soon to see if we can identify any clues or hints that the antibody levels, for instance, are declining, which may indicate that there's some waning immunity. But we don't have that information yet, especially for the cases in the United States. They just haven't been vaccinated for that long. So but we're going to be looking and interrogating that data as soon as we can to get some clues about what may be happening. But I will also say that when we look at the cluster in Chicago, for example, and the unexpected proportion of cases that were previously vaccinated, that's only one of the potential reasons why we could be seeing that phenomenon. Certainly, we'll be looking at it, but also we need to look at whether or not the virus has changed to overcome immunity, and we're going to be doing some whole genome sequencing of the viruses that, from the individuals that are involved with that cluster and continue to look at that sequence information from cases from across the country. We also need to look to see whether or not the specific vaccine lot or doses used were compromised in some way, or whether there were handling errors, or whether they were administered in some way that was flawed and didn't induce the immunity in that way. Yeah. And there are still other reasons why we might see a number of people with Mpox that were previously vaccinated that we're looking into. So just realize that we need to continue to this investigation to really know what's going on.
I'd like to thank everyone for joining us today. If there are follow-up questions, please call the press office at 404-639-3286, or you can email media@cdc.gov. And as a reminder, the contents of this briefing are embargoed until 1 p.m. today Eastern, when the report will be posted online. This will conclude our call. Sorry.
And this concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time. Speakers, please stand by.